This is a production of Cornell University.
Okay, everyone, we're going to go ahead and get started. I was joking with Jen that I don't believe in the concept of quorum because we don't take a ton of votes in here. And this semester, in order to make it more accessible for everyone, we're going to have some people coming late, some people coming early. If you saw the when to meet, it was chaotic and it made my heart kind of hurt, but I'm okay with it. I do two things that are kind of, you know, you might criticize me for being a little bit like, ooh, Spacey Joe. My first, especially for intense long committee meetings, I like to start just with a minute of kind of meditation, reflection, just to kind of ground everyone in the committee into the work that we're doing. So it's literally going to be a quick 1 minute. Like, I know it's going to seem a little weird. I'm just going to ask you to kind of like center yourself, think about this concept. Today, since it is Valentine's Day, we are going to think of the concept of love. What does that mean to you? How do you kind of think about it? Just to yourself, just think about it for a quick minute. And how do you think of love with inside of the code? How do we love every member of our community? So it's just a quick minute of just sitting in silence. I took that idea from Mary Beth Grant, who was a former judicial administrator at Cornell, now senior associate dean of students, so love to steal ideas. That's my passion. We'll be doing that. I know it's weird, but I'm going to keep doing that because I think it's a wonderful thing. So if we could look at the minutes from the December 9th and the February 5th. December 9th, that was, for those who weren't here, our last meeting of last semester. We have some, you know, key resignations from the committee, obviously. James resigned as well as the graduate. He said he could no longer. So we'll be working to reappoint him. And obviously, Kirabel has left, but we appointed new people last meeting to it. So if we could take a look at the minutes and let me know if there are any things to change. And if not, we'll go ahead and vote before it's... Thank you. All in favor of approving the minutes? Can you please raise your hands if you're ready? It's literally, thank you.
Unless you need the form.
I assume this. Perfect. Oh, yes. I'll do that after. I totally forgot. I said there were two things, and I only did one of the two things. We're going to do a quick round of introductions, because there are new faces, and I do think it's good to know the faces. So I'll start. We'll go around the table counterclockwise. I'm Joe. I am the chair of this committee. I'm also the president of the Student Assembly, senior in ILR. I've been doing this for quite a long time, so it's a concept.
I'm Matthew Ferraro. I'm a senior, and
I'm a junior in earth science and the major in chemistry and biology. I'm the undesignated representative at large on the student assembly, president of MGFC.
Mm-hmm. And what is MGFC, so everyone knows?
The Cultural Green Group for Central Council.
Great, thank you.
I'm Mariah. I'm a junior sitting policy and management. I'm the vice president for finance on the student assembly.
So I'm Bryce Corrigan. I'm a professor and for a lecturer in government, political scientist, statistician, long history of volunteering in assemblies and things like this, and I apologize in advance for having to run out early. I'm going to be making sure to at least read the code that I'm charged with revising before next week. I can't replace Richard Hensel, but I will do my best.
I'm Gabrielle Cantor. I'm a third-year law student and I'm a judicial assistant counselor.
Hi, Lisa Lieberwitz. I'm a professor of labor and employment law in the ILR school, and because I'm a faculty representative on the CJC.
I'm Michelle Horvath. I serve as a judicial administrator, and I'm an ex officio member on the
committee. I'm Jen Michael. I am the employee assembly rep and the director of student services in architecture, art, and planning.
Thank you, everyone. We'll have more faces coming in, so as they come in, I'll do their introductions for them, because I think I know all of them who are coming late because of students. If we could take a look at the unofficial CJC meeting minutes on the 5th of February, obviously short.
Yep. It says University of Miami under the school that I recommend to look at is the University of Cincinnati.
Oh, yes.
It was hard because I was by Zoom. So
which point is that?
3M.
Thank you. Anything else? If not, if I can get a motion.
Motion.
Thank you. Is there a second? Thank you. All in favor of approving the unofficial meeting minutes? Raising hands. Perfect. And I'm assuming the same. Yep. Great. So I've tried to time it out, obviously, a little bit of a late start. The security in Jay Hall is quite a concept right now. Hello, Gavin. Good morning.
Hello.
This is Gavin.
My name's Gavin.
Any other things you wanted to share? No. So we're going to start with the Cornell Statement on Responsible Speech and Expression. I have a Google Doc. I will share it to the whole entire committee, just so you all have that, so you can all work on it as it goes. I'll project it up to the screen here.
Meantime, I guess we'll catch up one time.
Yes. Wonderful.
So I fooled around with it a bit, and I posted some edited version and track changes and box. I'm not sure if they saw it, but it did. I made extra copies. I forgot to write on there that it's my edit, so you might want to mark so it distinguishes it from, you know, the other. I did it without track changes when I made the copy, because otherwise I can't read it.
Thank you.
Sure.
I can do this on Zoom.
Hello, Kat.
Good morning, Kat. How are you? Obviously, for context, for anyone who doesn't know, one of the, you know, when we were revising last semester on the violation section or section one, however you want to refer to it, a lot of it dealt with speech and expression and the commitment that Cornell University has to it. And so University Counsel's Office and the Office of the President decided to just carve that part out and make a separate document because they thought it was important. Also, federal regulations with a new executive order on free speech and expression for college campuses, kind of, you know, push the university in this direction of saying, maybe we should have that so we can be very clear with it. And so that's what led to the first draft of this document. My hope, since it is short, we can kind of do this in the time frame, you know, that we have, so we can kind of get this one out of the way, since it is a shorter one. And so, yep, that's the kind of backstory to it. Professor Leibowitz, if you kind of want to walk through your changes as you're eating, I always pick the best time.
Okay. Well, so you can also, I don't know if you have a computer, you can also look at and track changes. I don't know, can you put up the thing that I did and so it'll show the track changes?
Yep.
It'll be easier.
Let's see if I can find it properly.
Some of this is moving things around, and some of it is omission. The first thing I did was to suggest changing the title to remove responsible speech. I'm not completely sure what responsible speech is, but it seemed to me more descriptive to say statement on academic freedom and freedom of expression. Similarly made, you know, a change in the first paragraph, I think, consistent with that. I moved the part about the president's authority to take action where there are, you know, imminent threats to the end. And I'm not going to talk about sort of small changes. I tried to tighten up the material about you know, the university faculty statement. I would note that the way that the council wrote this was simply to list from policy 6.4 about sexual harassment some provisions that come out of the procedures for how to deal with sexual harassment from faculty, which made no sense to me to do that way. So what I did was to take the core of it, which is the old statement from 1960 that the university faculty adopted at that time, and to simply use that part, you know, it's not the whole statement, but to use the parts that were selected by council, which I think are fine, and then to end, and then to remove the things about 6.4, which seemed to me to be out of context, like why are these here without the rest of it, since we already have the policy, and to end with the what may happen if the president needs to do something, you know, with to address an imminent danger. And I changed some of that paragraph around, but that's basically moving it and then doing some editing, some moving around, but also adding something. I don't know if people had a chance to read it, but that's the overview of what I was doing.
Thank you. I will give people like 2 minutes just to read it in the box. If you're not in the box, let me know. Or I see you in the box.
Yes, I think I am.
Okay, perfect.
Okay, great.
I have a really quick question. Why is this, it's to be obvious, is the president the only executive authority for everything in the code? So that was how they drafted it? Is that,
yeah.
That makes sense.
Well, and there are provisions in the original code about the president being able to take action if current policies are inadequate to actually address public order. And this kind of public order issue comes from New York state law that requires, you know, the sort of maintenance public order approach. And the other thing I want to just mention, Joe, is that, you know, it's true that as the president said, that the executive order came out from the president, you know, about free speech, because he cares a lot about free speech. But there haven't, as far as I can tell, and I just took a look here, there haven't been any regulations from agencies following it up. I mean, so it's kind of like a,
it's in flux right now a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's an issue we need to worry about. I think we should do this because it's a good thing to have free speech and academic freedom stated, but, you know, this was clearly, you know, done to, you know, for political purposes, so I don't think that that's really driving what's happening here.
Yeah, it's definitely not a driving factor for this document, that's for sure. I'm sorry, I'm going to give people continuous more thoughts. If you want me to scroll around on the box, let me know so I can highlight sections for people. But people don't have
anything.
Yes, Michelle.
So I like how you tightened up some of the top section of that. I like those edits. I think it's important to talk about the balance of policy 6.4 rights. And I think what happens is we would have an Indiana University clause, right? The importance of demonstrating that folks outside of their employment have the right to say what they want so long as it doesn't impact that. And so I do think that if we were to, instead of taking the whole kind of 6.4 statement, add in just a clause that says nothing should impact the application of policy 6.4 rights outside of the employment setting. So when we're talking about free speech, I think it's important to keep that part of the private citizen in there. Because I don't want folks just to think that there's free speech rights end at the doorway. So that would be the only part that I would recommend bringing in there, and then making sure that folks do have notice that they can be held accountable for their speech when it's inside the employment capacity. I just think there's a transparency piece that
I'm sorry,
is important.
I just don't understand which part you're referring to. That which part?
This kind of last part.
The generally speaking, employees have the right to communicate.
Oh, generally speaking.
And then also based on the protections afforded by academic freedom.
Okay.
I think that last chunk is important to keep in.
The whole thing as written?
Based on the protections all the way to the end of it.
So what we were talking about on the screen is this part right there that is stricken, keeping that part in for everyone.
Can I?
Yes.
I like the urge to put in things to say, you know, that protections of academic freedom apply in, you know, many contexts, and that, you know, that there those protections also go into considering whether speech is prohibited under Section 6, Policy 6.4 or something like that. But I think the way it's worded, somebody reading it would. I mean, I wouldn't understand it if I really didn't know what Policy 6.4 was about. It just wouldn't make any sense to me what this means. It's so particular to Policy 6.4 that it seems to me that we should have something more general. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, and that's where I define to say something, you know, nothing is, this academic freedom is balanced against Policy 6.4, and then keeping that generally speaking, employees have the right to communicate freely. Because I think we need to remind.
Concerning sexual harassment, I mean, something that states. I mean, it's just like, why would anybody know what Policy 6.4 is if we're writing this as a general statement for people to understand rights of free speech and academic freedom? Now they have to go look up Policy 6.4 and say, well, what is that about?
Then maybe call it like the name of it. I see those cases and I see what folks are saying is protected academic speech and it's not. And so I want to make sure that people are noticed that in our community we expect people to treat each other with respect and dignity, and these are the limits of where speech meets with our community values. And so I just,
mm-hmm.
yeah, well, there,
something
I,
more general.
Yeah, and so I'll
okay.
trust you to wordsmith on that, but I think
right.
it's just important
okay.
that we.
That
it.
Makes sense. I think that's true.
And even if you don't want to wordsmith, like.
No, I'm happy.
Okay. Yeah, I think just as a, like a. Point, like if this committee or individuals don't feel like, oh, I don't want to be the person to like go into the deep legal language of it, we can just send something up to University Council, say, here's the feelings, can you try to send us something back as quickly as possible? That's always an option just to improve workflow, but I really do appreciate all the wordsmithing that you do, because it always comes out wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
Third class in my Cornell career, I'm taking with you.
You get an A.
Thank you. Perfect. So, anything else on the kind of academic freedom and freedom of expression document?
I guess just backing up to my earlier question, why isn't it that all of us have the responsibility to ensure that we keep these commitments to free expression and respect for others safeguarded, not just the president? I guess my question was not very well posed. Which isn't to say that I don't want the president to report to us if there's a need for some additional action. But
anyone have thoughts on that?
Yeah.
Just kind of the overall document.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that what Bryce is doing is important in terms of that this reads as if it's only the president. Yeah. And my understanding from reading what the counsel's office did was that they thought that something should be in here saying in a crisis situation, something might have to be done, but that maybe something could be added that addresses what you're saying and then makes clear that there may be crisis situations where the top dog needs to just step in.
Yeah, I mean, the whole first paragraph is essentially passive voice.
Yeah.
I think ethical statements of ethical responsibility require us to take agency for ethical action.
Yeah.
So I will say, I think perhaps it's to like prevent people from like trying to like do, sorry, like vigilante work or like a like freelance thing out, trying to like, that, or but like encourage moments.
I'm sorry, I know you're right, but I couldn't really hear most of
you. You want me to say it for you?
Yeah.
I think it's a prevention of, like, vigilanteism, of, you know, individuals going off and policing that by themselves without having that sense of authority, without having an ability, a platform in order to really do it. I don't know necessarily, I think from a student perspective, like, that's a very true case of things happening of that work, and so I think that's what this, like, document attempts to prevent. And I think, obviously, the whole entire crisis situation, it really harkens back to, you know, that UVA-esque feel of, you know, when white supremacists marched on the lawn and everything like that. So I think that's kind of where this document's head is at. At least that's where my head went to.
Yeah, because I assumed it was from the 1960s.
Yeah.
Because that's where it was originally, coming from, like how to quell student protest.
Yeah. For real.
Wouldn't the action frame be curtailed by the code itself?
I think this document, when this document was explained to me, it wasn't one that had authority. It wasn't one that was going to be adjudicated upon,
right,
where the code was adjudicated upon. This, I think, is a very aspirational-based document, and a document that is really just, here's the world that we wish to live in of free speech, where I think that's kind of how I put this document in my head into the bank of all the documents that we look at. So, yes, it would be curtailed by the code, but it wouldn't be one that I think it's good to at least have that clarification within this document so we don't have confusion, you know what I mean? Or if I'm not making sense, tell me I'm not making sense.
No, I think you're making sense, but I just feel like there's a way to say that this is everyone's responsibility to protect while also balancing that with saying, you know, the president is only one with the authority. Because, this says, like, it's the president's authority and duty to protect. You know, there's a way to, like, balance that sentence with saying that it's everyone's responsibility, I think, without implying that, like, you know, you don't want to keep a safe situation.
I think that how I would kind of recommend would be create another paragraph that has the president's authority and stuff like that, and in the first paragraph we add in is the commitment that every member of the Cornell University community upholds the standards of free speech or whatever. Just like one sentence saying that, and then we can create a second paragraph saying, though the necessity is rare, and we'll chunk that out.
I think that's a really good idea. I transferred from UVA, and I was there during all of that. And I think people in the community definitely do take it on themselves to uphold it. Sometimes it can become extreme, you know, such. So I think, like, laying out what a president can do in a time of crisis and also, like, what community members can be expected to do. Obviously, people follow it whatever they wish, but I think it's a good idea.
want to add, I really didn't like having this public order thing in here at all.
Mm-hmm.
I really didn't like it. It doesn't seem to me to fit within an aspirational statement. I figured I was probably going to lose on that objection, you know, ultimately, so I thought, how could it be worded in a way that, you know, and I think that acceptable, and I think that Bryce's idea is a good one, you know, in terms of putting both in. But I feel like this is a real, it feels to me like it sticks out as something that doesn't fit in an aspirational document about rights. I understand why Council's office wants it in there. I understand, you know, what we're talking about, but I don't think it fits. I mean, I it like sticks out like the proverbial, you know, short thumb. Mm-hmm. Like, you're all right, but
Michelle.
I do recognize that it sticks out of other, but it needs to. Like, there needs to be limitations. And so I think about the fact that we all have to do card access today in this building, right? Because it was the balance of wanting people to be able to come, to protest, to occupy, but also balancing things like fire safety, fire codes, the amount of police that needs to be on site, right? So the idea of how do we make these balances and structures. And so I'm always for the perspective that if I'm going to give you your rights, I'm also going to tell you where the responsibilities and the limits are. And so I don't have so much of an issue of it sticking out, because I think that we want committee members to know the choices that they make and the consequences, and the fact that the president should have the right to maintain public order. And so maybe we can draft it in a way that's a little bit like less sticking out, but I think it's important to keep in the space where we're talking about rights.
I like the fact that the buck stops though somewhere. I mean, which is to say, you know, I don't think of the UVA case, I think of the Berkeley, Berkeley case, where responsibility ultimately fell upon the president or dean, I think, there. It's UC system, it was something.
The chancellor.
Chancellor,
yeah.
Thank you. And that was a good thing, but, you know, so here the buck is stopping at the president. I mean, I agree with Risa that it is weird that we have to make a statement like that here. It's sad.
Is it the positionality in the document that makes it stick out? Like, if we moved it to the bottom, like, it's a small thing in my mind, but I think the positionality in the statement might make a difference. So if we put it under the discussion of the 6.4, I think then it makes a little bit more sense reading.
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to do sort of all the wordsmithing on this one particular document, because we have the thing of putting in something about limits, and so you could have the harassment piece, and then this piece, I thought that this piece needs to come last.
Yeah.
I mean, the way council drafted was like smack in the middle of rights, you know, which was confusing.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Perfect. So everyone's okay with, are there other like general concept points that we can agree to? Want to discuss.
Can I just mention that I did put something which I thought was substantive as the change here in terms of the part we're talking about, of saying, you know, after the imminent threat. And I did change it to the active voice that the president needs to promptly report to the community. That's consistent with what was there before. But then I also added, and shall consult with elected campus governance bodies concerning the earliest possible restoration of such rights. It seems to me that was at least a more positive kind of approach.
Anything else generally on this document? If not, I guess we can move on. Keep going.
Sorry, one other thing. In the meetings we've had before this, we've generally thought of not putting in links, right, because you follow links, including one of the ones that was originally in the one from council. It took us to a link which then had a link that didn't work or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering, should we suggest taking out a link? This is kind of, you know, very mundane at this point, but should we take out the link?
Why do people stop? Hyperlinks.
What's
the web accessibility? Oh, sorry.
You go. Go.
What's the web accessibility piece with links and like the whole website needing to go accessible? There's something about.
All I know is hyperlinks. If it's hyperlinked, it cannot be to a PDF. It must be to a Word document.
Okay.
Or oh, another okay. web link.
Okay. Perfect.
That's all I know. Gabrielle. If we want to just establish a general rule that the committee itself would not favor any hyperlinks with inside of the documents, that's something I can communicate up. So on the procedural section too, I can say no hyperlinks, we're killing that concept.
I think we could have, you know, an appendix with some of these things.
Okay.
Because I think the core values are important to have in there.
Yeah.
So one of the dangers of excluding those kinds of links end up with just a continual misstatement, and many complaints to some of my colleagues that many of our documents, official documents on campus, sprawl, and you know we don't need to repeat ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So an appendix, I think, would be great.
Appendix over hyperlinks. I'll communicate that.
I would say. Take it out, but I think the statement of core values is an important piece of this
mm-hmm.
part of the document.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that we need to add it in there. It makes it very long, but not again.
Does that not appear anywhere else in the document?
It's in the code.
I don't think so.
It's in the code provisions, but not in here.
Right. We could refer to a page in the code
mm-hmm.
if we took out the hyperlink when it's all said and done.
Okay. So I'll say that the general feeling is an appendix, and if there can be more specificity, referring to future documents, you know, referring to specific pages in a document in another document or something like that. So those could be the two recommendations instead of a hyperlink.
Okay.
Any other thoughts on this? If not, I would love a vote to formally task Professor Leibowitz with
mm-hmm.
point on this document, and then we'll review it at the next meeting for a final vote that we can send to the UA. Gavin, thank you. Is there a second? Jim, thank you. All in favor of tasking Professor Leibowitz to Wordsmith and have it by next meeting? Thank you. Perfect. Great. Yeah, 6. I don't know, Professor Luke, did you vote in favor? Or?
Oh, yes.
Okay, 7-0-1.
Sorry,
you were writing, and I was like, maybe she just wants to abstain, because maybe she's like,
I'm good.
Perfect. Great. Progress. So next we'll be looking at the Student Code of Conduct. That's the other document. I will pull up. Here's as well, track changes. That's kind of where we can start walking through things. If you want to be the walkthrough person, Professor Leibowitz, and of your changes, and we'll kind of start off of that. I think we can do that. If we want to go page by page, or however best you want to look at it.
Yeah. My brain is still back in this. Each part. I was just thinking, if I were a student here, I think I might be wondering whether my free speech rights were clearly stated enough. You know, I'm happy to have the academic freedom of speech issues on faculty in there. Just kind of putting that out there, food for thought. Maybe the answer is fine.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. Okay. Right, so I went through in the time I had, and I got very noble because it's a Friday and I got really early to do just sections 1, 2, and 3 to see how it compared with what we had done the semester. And let me make sure I'm looking at the right thing. So some of it's just wording. I thought nourishing environment was kind of weird. tightening up a little bit. I like the fact, I thought it was a great idea to put in the core values there. Under the core values, I was playing around, and I think maybe that one deserves some discussion, with this concept that we've been dealing with, you know, for a long time, of really trying to create non-punitive educational objectives that can actually be implemented. So it seems to me that as soon as you're talking about sanctions, you're talking about punitive measures, and that deserves some statement separately to say we still want those to advance educational goals to the greatest extent possible. But it seems to me that a sanction is a sanction, and a sanction is punitive, you know, so maybe that deserves some discussion. But I don't think I really changed the spirit of what was being said there. That was at least my hope. Same kind of thing on the next paragraph. I just thought that the way it was worded was a little confusing to me, so I tried to clarify what I thought the meaning should be. Scrolling down to the other parts, I don't think I made any huge changes. Oh, the one part I think is a little strange, and maybe I think we should discuss is this is on page 4 about responsibility for your guest misconduct. I'm a little uncomfortable with that kind of responsibility for things that other people do, but I tried to change it in a way that I thought was more acceptable. I don't know what it means the way it was originally written. It seems to me confusing to say students can be held responsible for complicit misconduct arising from the behavior of their guests. I don't know anybody who could actually translate that. That's as far as I got, actually. I said section 3, but I didn't have a chance to really even review the rest of the transcript stuff. And so that's my plan, to try to do more. But that's as far as I got, anyway.
Okay. So, thanks for the conversation. I think we'll first discuss the two paragraphs that you mentioned. Which, you know, after my quick read, I was like, this makes sense. So if we want to center the discussion there, and then we'll move on to the kind of complicitness of guests, and then we'll go through the rest of the sections. Because I think most of section 1 is copy-paste from core values, really. Section 2 also is pretty much in line with what we did last semester. So I will center the discussion there. If people have thoughts right now,
Where are we starting?
It is under, it's right after the core values, so it's,
okay.
This code contains not only Cornell, it's...
Yeah, I got it right here.
Perfect. Yep, Michelle.
So one of the things that I actually like about the current code, which is a minimal thing, I think that one of the things is missing is the idea of the protection of the community in this current version, because this is a place where people live, work, study, and so it seems like the edits are only talking about the educational environment, so unless we really clarify that education also goes outside the campus classroom, I think that's important to know. One of the things that we always hear from students is that if you have non-punitive code, how can you suspend or dismiss people?
Mm-hmm.
So I think we do also need to have a clause that talks about that sometimes the most important educational intervention is a departure from the campus. So I do think we need to balance complainants' rights in that regard. So those are the only kind of two pieces that I have in that section that I would add for comment.
Okay.
And then there's some parts in the bill that I might wordsmith a little bit, but I can do that later. Just I like what you added, but I think I want to get rid of the fall 2019 because the idea that hopefully these become our core values and we don't need to designate when they occurred.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some pieces that I'll send to the committee for edits, but with those two sections, those are what I have.
Gabrielle.
I just wanted to, you know, echo the Michelle's statement about the non-punitive, punitive aspect.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's important to recognize.
Okay.
Right. Was I understanding correctly that another part of the comment was also that as revised, the statement talks a lot about non-punitive educational objectives, that since it's not just an educational community, you want to add a part that emphasizes that the code governs conduct. In activities that are not simply the educational, like living on campus.
Yeah, so we're talking about like of advancing Cornell's educational goals, as long as we clarify that education is curricular and co-curricular and the development of the person and not just as a student.
Is that something that you're going to work on?
Yeah. Perfect.
I'll also send out, I have the student code in a Google Doc as well, so I'll send that out. I have like a folder, so I'll send the link to the folder and everyone should then have access to it. So people can do all their edits in there and we can kind of...
Oh, so don't edit this one?
Don't edit anything in Box.
Okay.
Box was just like the holding tank for everything,
okay.
But the Google Doc is actually the one where we can all kind of play with language, and I think that's the best way for us to communicate. Box, after a while, when you start editing it, I'm like, version 707, I'm like, what the heck? So we'll do Google Doc. Okay, yes. Thank you, Michelle. Keep moving. Yep.
Just an admin point, Wendy is going to come in a little bit later and help with the rest of the meeting, but I will be doing an event via audio, so you guys should look at it.
Thank you.
Tonight or by Monday.
Thank you, Matt.
Yes. So I've not worked on a campus that the code doesn't also govern behavior off campus ever in my whole professional career.
Yes.
So if a student like goes to Wegmans and steals a cart full of groceries, hypothetically, this happened at my previous institution. They did do this, believe it or not. And they came back to campus as obviously a police report and a pickup. Then we held them responsible on campus because they're stealing, right? And then I have to put these people in my community. They're living in my residence halls, and they have this. They're stealing, and I didn't find that as a, I found that as a safety concern for my other residents within the buildings that they lived. Do we not worry about that here at Cornell? And I know it says only substantial threat to the educational mission is, or the health and safety of individuals. Would that fall under there? Does behavior of students outside of Cornell not impact how they behave at Cornell? I'm just curious about that point.
I think that that point, and so I think there are two aspects of it that in this code I think they address. The one is interaction with criminal proceedings, which is under Section 3, Subsection C, and also the jurisdiction, so Section 3A.
I'm in jurisdiction.
Yeah.
Right? That's where I would.
So.
And it's just, I mean, it's just an interesting thought to think that. It's an interesting way to state it, because I don't know if everything's necessarily a threat to the educational mission or the health and safety of individuals, unless you think, like, yes, it's a threat to the safety of my students in a residence hall if this student is behaving erratically somewhere else, you know?
Michelle? Yeah, I've been on campuses where it's jurisdictional limitless or jurisdiction to campus activities. In our current code, it talks about a serious disruption to the educational environment versus substantial. So if there's behavior that's off campus, I currently ask the Dean of Students, the Dean of Faculty, or the Vice President of HR, depending on the constituency class. I've defined serious under my leadership as one of five things. That is, it's any sort of physical contact, any sort of hazing, any drug sales or distribution, any property damage over $500, or sort of a miscellaneous weird category that is kind of a catch-all that we look at it on a case-by-case basis. And so I don't think in that current definition those would fit. So like that Wegmans example, if it was,
if
it was $250, I would have been crossed off campus jurisdiction. If it was $500, I would be crossed off campus jurisdiction.
And where are those five things listed in the code so students know about them?
It's not, unless it is just kind of how I want to type some sort of parameters of, of what it is. So.
I think kind of those examples harken to two paragraphs within the jurisdiction. The third paragraph and then the fifth paragraph. I think the fifth paragraph being final determinations made by DETA students, but then the third paragraph is really where they try to list out conduct is regardless of location except for these ones, and I think that's where they kind of tackle this question.
I do think that's one of the things that is worth our community deciding if we want to have a limitless jurisdiction. Or to say these are the categories that we would specifically spell out. I do think that transparency piece is important. And I know that our folks from International Health and Safety have talked about that they don't want limits because of folks who are in study abroad programs and things of that nature. And so I do think listening to some of those voices are important to consider.
Professor Rosa and Gabriel.
I thought you pointed at me first.
Sorry.
Well, I mean, it does say regardless of location. I mean, my personal view is to not have a limitless reach of the code. I mean, I think that this takes care of it, but it would be good to hear from other constituents, you know, see what they have to say. I also wanted to point out that one of the things that I suggested in my edits was to, as you see, remove or to the university's reputation, which seemed to me to be limitless. in terms of its potential scope, and my experience here has been that, you know, the concern by the administration for reputation is different from my view of the impact of different things on university reputation. So I just think that's too ambiguous and potentially, you know, just overbroad, you know, in its limitlessness.
Gabrielle?
I guess mine is more of a question. So why wouldn't the study abroad fall under the first, like, prong of that? So if behavior occurs in the context of a university program.
Because
what if a student took a semester off and applied to a different school? Or what if they were not going to a Cornell-sponsored program?
But it doesn't say, because in other parts of the code it says specifically Cornell-sponsored, whereas to me I think, especially because, you know, if you read one in conjunction with regardless of whether the university is a session, to me it seems to suggest that that would be, that would include, even if it's not a Cornell-sponsored program, if it's just, I mean, because you do still have to, like, what, apply through the study abroad office to go abroad, right?
Not always.
You can take a leave.
Yeah.
But then you're not a student, I guess.
Yeah. Well, leave is a very tricky
thing. Right, it is a tricky thing, right? It totally depends on how you apply it.
Well, but, so, the it defines student, though, as, like, as soon as you, you know, are on campus based on different factors, and then when you're dismissed. So, I mean, you are still considered a student even if you're at, university or whatever.
But if, so I think the example that, you know, you can go on leave from the university, therefore you become not a student, and then you do a study abroad that way. So that's where the leave policy is one that is being worked on by the university. So it's always, so it's in, currently in flux, and it's not under our purview. And so I think it's good to consider. And so it's good to consider it, but understanding that that one is probably going to be changed to allow the university a little bit. I don't know where they're thinking, but in my mind, a little bit more leeway in considering who is and who is not a student. Michelle.
Yeah, so kind of another example of this is when, let's say a student goes on study abroad, and let's say the activities for the day end at 5 o'clock. And then let's say they go off campus and they smoke marijuana. I don't define that as being part of the educational experience. To say that when you're doing study abroad, that would mean that every student goes to Amsterdam and then a great conduct code event. That's just not. But let's say that they were having to be required to live on campus in that housing, and they were drinking alcohol in that building, and they were underage, then yes, I would say that's within the context. So maybe I've been narrowly reading this too much, but I think that's the balance that they were trying to talk about.
Right. So can I then ask a question about that? And in part,
this also relates to the, I would like to know more about the catch-all category that you mentioned, because I really liked the, I liked the idea of setting forth the categories, but then I was concerned about the last category and whether, you know, what that really means, because maybe that needs to be, like, we want to analyze it to try to make it as clear as possible what it is, but I was thinking, you know, what if two members of the community, you know, outside of the hours of their program, you know, if one engages in misconduct towards the other, then to me that seems to fall under harm to a member of the community. And I like that better than reputation, which seems really ill-defined, or sort of just too broad and general, and maybe more about media engagement and stepping on our toes in other ways, whereas, you know, two members of the community interacting with one another, would that then fall under the jurisdiction if it's outside of the context of the study abroad program?
Yeah, so that would fall under any time that there's physical interactions with, I always request off-campus jurisdiction. A weird one that kind of went off-campus, as an example, like that fifth category, is that we had a student who had an internship with a company, as in that regard, you know, was a Cornell affiliate, they took the leave to do that, and they were stealing trade secrets, and so we requested off-campus jurisdiction. So that's kind of that weird, that weird category.
I
think there might be some value in outlining for the transparency piece those five serious things, because wouldn't students want to know that?
I guess my question is,
what if it changes?
We're flipping the code, like this proposal flips it, where this is limitless, and therefore if we have a limit, if we have a limitless code now, we're moving from a limited to a limitless, so we would have to actually define things that are not covered, because that's how I'm reading this section of jurisdiction. I'm reading it, the code will apply regardless of location, it covers all behaviors by Cornell students. Like, I'm reading this in a limitless sense, and so then I'm, you know...
Oh, I don't read it as limitless.
Okay.
Because that when
mm-hmm.
dictates that mm-hmm. it's in the elements, it has to be in the context of the university program,
right.
Or it poses a substantial mm-hmm. threat if it's not on campus.
Okay.
So they're actually not saying that's a limitless.
Okay.
It would be a period after location if it was limitless, right?
Yeah.
Yes. I'm reading it.
Yeah.
Mariah?
Oh, yeah, I guess I was just a little bit confused how it poses, like how, I guess, off-campus activity is always posing a threat. And kind of like the example with the trade secrets, like, yeah, that's very legal, but I guess in my mind that isn't, like, who's negatively affected on campus by, like, somebody else's bad actions at their internship.
Yeah.
So that's why I was a little bit confused. Or even this feeling, like, okay, you stole groceries at Wegmans, but, like, that doesn't affect, like, people on campus, I guess, is my question.
Well, for my example, I saw it as what's to say they're not going to steal from the people down the hall from them. And so it was treated very much as, like, you stole from Wegmans. Now, that could that pose a safety issue in the residence hall? And this wasn't here. This was that.
Right.
Yeah,
but still, yeah.
That's how I looked at it.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And then we also had a piece in our code that said any violation of state or local law would also be addressed in our code. And so because they were arrested and violated state and local law, then we held them responsible for that on campus as well.
I'll let Michelle respond to Ryan, then I'll get to you, Jay.
Yeah, so in that kind of stealing trade secrets, that company no longer hires Cornell students as internships, right? And then the idea of, we always talk about what does a Cornell degree actually represent, and it represents two things. It represents the academic integrity of the institution and the reputational of the institution. And so I always say that compare this with like a Brigham Young, right? Like their degree academically is on par with ours, right? The rigor and things. But our degree certifies very something different. So an employee hiring someone from Brigham Young knows that there's likely going to be no alcohol violations. There's going to be different standards. Compare a TC3 degree, right? Their behavior reputation actually mirrors ours, but our academic requirements are different. And so when we think about how does it directly impact people, address their ability to be like future hired, and then it starts to devalue the base of the degree. But not hiring students is the direct way that mm-hmm. it impacts it.
Okay.
So I'm assuming that like any violation of New York State law like is also like, you know, can prosecute it here? No? Okay.
So, price and ethic. I think gray areas fall though under things under the anything that's harmed to reputation. So I completely understand why the point that you're making. I think it's a valid point. I think it seems like that has to be decided here. But without taking a position, I can think of cases where I'm not sure I would want that to apply. Like if a student takes privileged materials or university property and uses it in a way that the university doesn't like the Cornell logo or something like that, then I guess the question is, I think the Cornell, well, I don't know. I guess what I'm wondering is, what are the boundaries to reputation? Because the code probably is very explicit about how we use the Cornell name, but there must be things that something can do in public that would embarrass the university, but we won't be able to spell out all those things. So I'm wondering how we decide that and put that in.
So one question I have is, Michelle, you had said you used the term serious, and I was wondering, is serious more serious than substantial? How do you compare the two?
I think serious is less than substantial.
It's less than substantial. Yeah, because it's not obvious, so I guess that's just one question, serious versus substantial. So you're saying that you think substantial requires more to assert jurisdiction, more evidence to justify asserting jurisdiction, okay. And then the other thing is about the reputation piece. I mean, I just think it's too ambiguous. This seems to me to cover a lot, this paragraph. I mean, location, regards location, when the behavior occurs in the context of university program activity, that covers a lot. Or poses a substantial threat to the university's educational mission, the health or safety of individuals, whether those individuals are affiliated with the university or not, or the university community. I mean, that covers a lot. Now, the kinds of things that Michelle was describing seem to me to fit in comfortably into that area, including, it hasn't occurred to me that this person stealing trade secrets, had the consequences of, people not being able to go to that place anymore. And so that's at least arguable in terms of a connection, as opposed to another situation where somebody might be in some kind of an internship not connected to Cornell, the person's on leave, does something, and you wouldn't want to assert jurisdiction, but you have a discretion according to what you've decided, what you've described in terms of whether something is either serious or substantial, whichever one we use. So I don't see any need to add anything to this because it already covers a lot off campus.
I didn't raise my hand. I'm really bad at that. I apologize. What do we do if a student's on leave and does something terrible? We don't have jurisdiction over them, and then they apply to come back.
We do have jurisdiction over them.
Okay.
The way that the current code is written. And so if a student commits a violation while on leave, mm-hmm. or let's say they commit a violation and then they realize, no, I need to take a leave, we give them the option to adjudicate it while they're on leave or upon their return. And so a lot of the behavior that we see prior to leave is a student who realizes that maybe they need a little mental health counseling, and so they do a very intensive inpatient treatment, and so we adjudicate.
Okay.
Michelle,
I can see people's thoughts on the reputation. I don't think that's currently in our code, and maybe I'm misdoing that. I think part of kind of to answer your point, regards is the idea that the reason why there's so much vetting of the person who sits in the JA's position is because you're wanting to hire someone who you trust has that discretion, mm-hmm. right? And the idea that the checks and balances are through the system, right, through how the case gets adjudicated. If there's an external lawsuit based on how someone, there's a check and balance on that. And then there's employment. So if somebody was in this seat and they're acting so far beyond the purview of what's appropriate, or if I were to say, okay, anyone who crosses with a jaywalking is going to request off campus jurisdiction, right? Like that would be.
Yeah, I mean, I was trying to think of something that was ambiguous about its seriousness, and it had to involve something that we would ordinarily consider very disrespectful in community.
could be interpreted as outside of the kind of environment. And I guess maybe that is something we have to defer to the JSA.
Because people ask me to take off-campus direction all the time, and I turn it down. So, for example, we have some students who have a lease conflict. And they request off jurisdiction because they say, well, it's going to
we'll never rent to the university.
Exactly. Yeah. And I was
really?
Like, no, this isn't. This is go to civil court to do that. So I think it's part of trust in the person who you hire, and then as you hire new people, how you best make sure they have that. So yeah, I don't know if that builds more trust, but just kind of how it does happen.
So I'm getting the sense that we kind of overall like the language and jurisdiction with the university reputation stricken out, and we'll pose this as a question in public forums to people, and we'll give a lot of context, and we'll allow them to really weigh in on this issue, and we'll keep moving forward with it. I think, you know, it seems like we kind of know what's up with it. Gabrielle. Yes.
Wait, so then are we abandoning the point about making it more transparent with, like, the factors?
I can add. I'll draft some edits for the
okay. We'll put some stuff
yeah,
in the Google Doc.
I can, like,
just to clarify, it doesn't apply to, like, returning the majority of
yes.
houses. Mm-hmm. I feel like it says completely education, but also, like, houses, not houses.
So half of our property, like, we have 10 organizations that are on campus. And then the rest of them are off campus and, let's say, annexes. So let's say we have a fraternity, if the idea that this code is in that fraternities and sororities are under the code. Let's say that they're providing alcohol to minors, right? So not a serious violation, but enough that if it was on campus, we would say, hey, fraternity, come in. We're going to do a sanction that looks at maybe doing educational protocols and looking at your event management and FIPC guidelines. If they were providing alcohol to a campus, a house off campus, we don't get the right to have that educational intervention.
Even though they're a student organization?
In my reading, you would.
We would have behavioral, we would have personnel jurisdiction, but not behavioral location jurisdiction.
Yeah, I got it.
I guess I'm confused why you let the kid at the internship, you would have jurisdiction over that, but not over an annex and college. Because they're just as much students. I guess I'm getting a little bit confused then.
So it's the idea of the serious provision, right? So providing alcohol to minors, not seen as serious, right? If it's an annex or fraternity, and let's say they're hazing, I always request off-campus jurisdiction. So it's based on the violation and the equity of that. And so I do think I don't read this where it says, regardless of location with the behavior in the context of a university program or activity, a party isn't a program or activity that the university sanctions. So even though we're saying that the behavior or the personal jurisdiction of the fraternity or sorority is met, the location's not met.
I don't even think, where I'm reading, actually fraternity sororities are actually covered is in the first paragraph, university-recognized student organizations and living groups included. I don't even think we need to even look at location at that one. I think, you know, if you say all of these members, this is an annex in which every member of living there is a member of the same fraternity, I think the dots connect. Like, I think they're interpreting that. No? Hi, Jen, and I have a lot of people on this point. Jen, Gavin, Uche, and then I'll let you two.
Aren't fraternity parties registered now under Pollock's, like, process that it would be a sanctioned event, even if it's off campus?
But let's say it's not a sanction. Let's just say it's
they're just doing it without, like, the Super Bowl Sunday, we're giving off all the minors.
I'm shocked that we wouldn't have jurisdiction over that.
Hi, Gavin, who's right?
Oh, I was going to do the same thing. Not even with the new, new provisions on the Greek Life, but still, even before that, Greek Life registered events in offices to read fraternal living.
She's saying one of them's not registered. They're just throwing
a
party.
Okay, I'm now with it.
That they're off-campus property.
Uche, you good? Michelle and Gabrielle.
I mean, I just read this as in the same way that you do need jurisdiction over the individual or organization itself. And then, because
if you read the first paragraph, the first sentence is about the individual or the organization. The second sentence is the location. So, I mean, you do need to meet both of those elements separately in order to have jurisdiction. So it's not, you know, just the conduct over you as an individual, regardless of where you are.
Michelle?
So, like, right now, the jurisdictional standards in our code is that it's, you have to have a personal jurisdiction, so it's faculty or staff outside their workplace, students, student organizations, not Greek. Then you have to have behavioral location, so it has to be on campus or serious enough to do that. It has to be within 365 days, and there actually has to be a code provision to do that. And so this is saying that I defer to Gabrielle's interpretation as well.
Jen?
What about, and this is, you know, what about students that under an academic department provide alcohol to minors or potentially haze? Where does that fall in the code? That's not a student club. It's not a registered organization, but it's an academic department. How do we address that?
Could you give an example? I don't think
like, say the English department. I'm making this up. Okay. I don't even work in arts and sciences.
I was about to be, architecture planning actually is just not in trouble for this.
Right? Yeah. Well, that's where I work.
I
know. So what happened? What
so
happened?
So they do, like, initiation, but I understand that as a student, and the students, it's like the second year students are the first years, not as the department. So I guess I'm also having an issue with the department.
Would that be department, though, if it's the second-year student?
That's a small Cornell student.
I'm just asking, like, student perspective of it.
Michelle.
And code perspective.
So I'm going to use the context of the English department, because I think that's a nice place to ground it for a minute. Sorry to English majors if you all are offended if there's any in here. So right now our current definition doesn't say anything about academic. It doesn't include the academic space as a space for hazing. So the definition is limited. But let's say, for example, they made people snort coke and put their head in a hot oven because they're focused on Sylvia Plath, right? Like, that's what they're doing. we've taken it over. Sorry.
I'm a lot more comfortable with the Super Bowl party.
I love the
glad little chapter.
Snorting
coke in the oven, but,
yeah. But this is conduct work. This is why it's such an interesting work for me whenever else we go into it. Right, so we could say maybe they could be charged with providing drugs on campus, and we could charge them with endangerment, right? So let's say, for example, like even in our current code of conduct, you could have marijuana paraphernalia. That's not covered by the standards. So a lot of it is dependent on that. So if the code were to rise and say that, you know, if you want to say, if it was part of the English students get to know you, first year to second year thing, you would have to change the definition of hazing, but you could charge them with other provisions of the code. Okay.
Interesting. Cool. You have a confused look, so
yeah, I'm a little puzzled by some of the examples, but everybody else is clear, that's fine. But
yeah.
I did have a question.
Yeah.
There's just a little one. I had added back in university registered or university recognized, and the truth is I don't know where we are right now on those meetings. Is university recognized sufficiently broad so that it includes everything?
It would have to be both, in my opinion, because there is a separate policy of recognition and then there is a policy of registration, and those are two different types of orders.
So they still are, right?
Yes.
Okay, so I added back in university registered. The council's office, I don't think, had it. Yeah, they just have recognized.
Okay.
Perfect.
Kat? If you want to type it, I can say it.
okay, there we go. Just to return to the Greek line really quickly, just to clarify, so you could have jurisdiction in like off-campus Greek houses if you request it. That depends on severity. Is the reason that OJ doesn't request off-campus to be that like bandwidth or just don't want to deal with those cases?
So it depends on the type of case, right? So if it falls into those five categories, right?
But I can't with good conscience ask the dean of students to say, is this serious behavior on our campus conduct to give alcohol to minors? Or to smoke weed in an off-campus annex? That doesn't rise to serious. If when we're starting to articulate these five things, if people have different perspectives that they want articulated, that's completely fine. But I don't think in good conscience I could say that fits our serious definition.
But is that not resulting in a double standard of student conduct?
Yes.
Yeah.
And literally, if you're on one, like, part of the work that we do is what side of the sidewalk on Eddie Gate?
Mm-hmm.
Where people.
I was going to say, yeah. You actually get, like, very fine lines.
Yeah. We literally had one case where a student fell, and the alcohol was in their pocket on campus, but their feet were off campus. And so we adjudicated on where the alcohol was at. Right, and so, like, these are the.
That's crazy.
Gabrielle. Wait, Gabby. Wait. Gabrielle.
So, I mean, I definitely recognize, like, the absurdity sometimes of, you know, where to draw the line, but I think more broadly, though, what the concern would be is that, you know, a regulation of conduct completely off campus and students' personal time and their personal spaces, and so, you know, definitely recognize that sometimes it creates the double standard, but I just want everyone to be mindful of, like, the implications of starting to dive too much into off-campus jurisdiction.
Gavin?
I absolutely agree, but I think just, like, what is circulating around the table, at least for the students, is that we are seeing, like, a recurring issue with Greek life on campus, not only fraternities, but also sororities. So we're trying to say, like, how can we cope to make ameliorate that?
Gabrielle, Risa?
I think my suggestion, then, would be to maybe, like, use the public forum, public comment, to kind of explore this issue, because, you know, I think maybe student leadership agrees on that, but I wonder how, you know, like a sophomore who isn't as familiar with the system right now would feel about that.
Lisa?
Yeah. So, is this discussion about Greek life still the same discussion in terms of the fraternities and sororities being recognized but not registered? Is that still the issue? Because I really haven't kept up with exactly what President Pollack did, you know, and where things stand. Is that still the same issue, or
so,
has it changed?
So I think the discussion is really, you know, when we look at the recognition policy, we talk about, you know, can we take this where does this organization fall currently in a judicial
right.
system? And since they're recognized, they're under a judicial system that is not under the purview of the OJA and the code.
Mm-hmm.
I think the discussion we're having is, it is common practice, obviously, to have all these annexes throughout College Town, and are these annexes part of that fraternity? And, like, is that jurisdiction part? Like, if, you know, if you use that annex for your party, saying, you know, it's a XYZ fraternity party, is that, and it's in an annex, can we go off campus, and is that a jurisdictional that we think we can act upon? Like, why is it so different that you're in this off-campus place and not in your house?
But strictly in terms of asserting jurisdiction over individuals as opposed to the organization, right?
I think this draft actually says that the debate of whether they're recognized or registered is done because the council's putting them under the code.
Yeah, that's what I'm.
Yeah,
that's what I'm trying to figure out here.
Yeah,
exactly.
To me, that's. I think the idea of, you know, that recognition policy would be gone by this.
So you could assert jurisdiction over the organization in a way you couldn't before?
Yes.
Okay.
Let me clarify that.
Okay.
I don't have jurisdiction over the fraternities and sororities, and I don't know what the OSFL policy is with behavioral jurisdiction location, if that's different. I always have jurisdiction over the individuals,
right.
But if the behavior is not serious and it's off campus, then there's a difference.
But that's not what this says.
Yeah, this is including.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, but the question, the next part is the behavioral location jurisdiction, which would limit it. Because even, so let's say that the fraternity house is off campus, or the sorority house, if we're saying that there's jurisdiction within the personal jurisdiction,
mm-hmm.
but if you don't have that behavioral jurisdiction, you still don't have jurisdiction over that.
Just because of the location piece. But this would be a significant change, right? The first paragraph.
Yes. This is saying, like, we're getting rid of that other system.
Okay.
So, can I offer, I mean, I can
I think there are significant questions in this off-campus jurisdiction question, especially relating to the Greeks. Is there a set of questions that I can ask clarification from counsel, what their intent was and what the spirit of this was? I think, you know, I can ask the question, you know, you put the Greeks under this code, but how does this relate? Like, what were your thoughts about how a Greek organization living off campus in an annex, like, can I pose that question to counsel's office for us to get clarification? And then, you know, if they come back and they say, oh, no, our intention was if you're in an annex, that is not even an off-campus, like, okay, I'll pose that to university counsel, and I'll get a response back, and I'll share that response with the committee, because I do think that's really important for us to know going into public forum.
Yeah, I think generally asking, and some of the specifics are good, but generally asking what the way that they wrote this, what is the nature and scope of jurisdiction of the code and the JA's office over fraternities and sororities as organizations and as individuals within the organization. It's not clear to me that, I mean, it sounds like it's much broader, but I don't know if that's what they meant.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I will pose that question to them and a set of questions to get as much clarification as possible. Michelle?
I yield.
All right.
I have to run.
That's okay.
I apologize, and I will come more well informed, so I have better examples.
That's
okay.
Side question.
Yeah.
So is there, like, a move from wanting to bring more of the jurisdiction to the Greek rights under the campus teaching code? Is it more so because they assume, like, possible has a little more, like, jurisdiction over what happens, like, with Greek rights?
In its current form right now, Oswald is the only one that looks at the organization. But in this draft, it is bringing those organizations under the code. And so OSPL would no longer be an adjudication unit. It would be the OJA and the UHRBs.
But that wouldn't necessarily prohibit internal regulation, right?
No, it wouldn't.
By the fraternities and sororities. I mean, they could say, well, we think that the responsibility should be greater.
Yeah. Right? They still would be subject to the event management guidelines that they have that are from that area, but all these behavioral violations in Section 4 and the prohibited conduct, all of that stuff would be under the OJA. So hazing cases would move out of OSPL into the OJA, but, like, event management cases in which that, oh, your vendor was not a licensed vendor would still lie within inside of OSPL.
So is there a reason why, like, hazing cases would, like, right, like, is it because, like,
this is from University Council. University Council has said that this is where they stand.
Okay. University Council.
Risa and Gabrielle.
I mean, I'm just thinking that whether it happens or not, that it seems to me the code would preempt the fraternity sorority councils or whatever they're called, you know, from saying the code is floor,
mm-hmm.
and we are going to have further internal regulations that, you know, cover things that aren't covered, but also perhaps find violations where the code wouldn't find violations. Am I wrong about that?
No.
Okay.
Gabrielle and Michelle.
So does OSPL right now have broader off-campus jurisdiction than this?
Depends on what that. I don't believe that they do, but I think that they, but I don't think there's a check upon that. So, I'm this is totally, like, me hypothesizing, but I can almost guess that if there is a hazing case of a Greek organization and the hazing is occurring off campus, that I think they are going ahead and looking at the hazing, and I think they are going ahead and investigating that. To be also fair, they use a very different model than what we do. They use the single investigator model, where the code does not. Look at procedures coming forward. So they have an investigator that goes out and fact finds and creates a narrative and creates evidence and everything like that, and then presents that to a review board.
I wouldn't say he creates the evidence. He gathers.
Gathers
evidence.
Yeah, he's not going out. It's like, ooh, look at that. yes.
And then I guess my second question is, if you can impose, you know, greater restrictions or whatever, that those wouldn't have the, like, the same behavioral, like,
you provide more clarification?
You
like
kick somebody out of the Trinity kind of thing would be different, right?
Yeah.
I'm wondering what the,
right, what could they do?
Yeah. Michelle.
Yeah.
So this is the first campus that I've been on in which group life is not under the code. So the way that it typically works is, let's say you have an organization and they had an unregistered Super Bowl party. And they were providing alcohol to minors and things of that nature. What would happen is that the conduct office would see if there's enough to hold the responsible, the organization, because sometimes it might just be like two people in the room and everyone's like, yo, like, we did not know about this. And then we would look for the individuals. and then that would be it. The fraternity would, they could do internal membership to say, like, we have a lobby person in our chapter, which they have the right as a third party person, but our office wouldn't provide that information to them. Where we see a lot of the shared governance with fraternity life is things like recruitment or intake violations, because those aren't prohibited by the code. So let's say I worked at a campus where they did door stack, and they're like, well, the door stack went 3 seconds past the time, so their panel of counsel adjudicated.
You know the crazy videos where you see all of them out in the front of the door?
Yeah, they like pile up and they create a human pyramid.
Yeah.
There was checking out. Yeah.
I'll send that video out to the committee.
Yeah. Please do one from Ole Miss where I saw it in person. So they would, but the individual aspect wouldn't be. But so the council, in theory, shouldn't impose additional violations. So the recognition would be under the code.
Great. Recognizing time, it is 10:28. I will pose a set of questions about jurisdiction to your group council to get those clarifications as quickly as possible so people can ruminate upon the thoughts. For next meeting, I want to finalize the academic freedom and freedom of expression, get that so we can vote done with it, not have, get something off the docket. Prohibited conduct, we did all of that last semester, and I've never looked at it. So, I think we can look at it side to side, and if we look at it, and we say basically what we have, I think we can just check that part off. I don't think we're going to have a ton in there, honestly. And we can go back to jurisdiction. And then I really don't think there's much to do in the student code anymore, to be quite honest with you, after we get clarification on jurisdiction and stuff like that, because it pretty much rounds itself out.
There's actually a lot of the prohibited conduct because we didn't actually go through it.
Yeah.
I'm happy to send out some edits this week for people, and Gabrielle will try and do those too earlier if you all have thoughts to do that. But there's a lot that both of our offices agree on that needs to be changed on those kinds.
Okay. If you can put that in the, I'll send out the links to the Google Docs. So put everything in the Google Docs, put it as suggestions and not actually as changes. In the next meeting, we'll go through all of those suggestions and we'll just start knocking them out, and then we'll be good for that. I think this thing can get done really, really quickly, so I think that can be our next meeting goals. Our next meeting goals is, I think we can get both of these done. That's my, but next week we'll also get the procedure section, so from University Council. So I will send that to the committee, the procedures, but recognizing that we most likely will not talk about it at our next Friday meeting. Just to put thoughts in. And then anything else, if you have questions that come up, you're like, what's up with this, and this, please send me to me, and I can get answers really quickly from University Council. Teresa?
Yeah, I did have a request,
yes.
Just for myself, if it's not a big burden on, like, Michelle or Gabrielle. If there are lots of changes, the suggestion part is great, the Google Docs, but if you can provide like a separate track changes so that we can actually look at it,
yeah.
I find that just my brain works better that way.
Yeah. And if you want to do like a memo or something where like I think those are fantastic, like it's like here's all the recommendations we have here, like here's our rationale for all of them in a memo so people can read that so we don't have to talk about it in the committee necessarily, I think that's wonderful. Any other questions, comments, concerns for me?
Andrea.
She is one of our grad reps.
Oh, cool.
Yep. She couldn't make it today.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Please let me know how much I can help going forward.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.